everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, episode number 265. My name is Patrick Gray. On this week's show, we're chatting with Rex Warren of Leviathan Security in the United States. Leviathan has been working with DARPA on an interesting new system that can fairly reliably detect failed zero-day exploitation attempts against hosts. Basically, these guys are grabbing Dr. Watson crash dumps at gateways, which isn't really the interesting part. The interesting part is when we look at what they do with those crash dumps, and we'll be hearing all about that a little bit later on in the show. This week's podcast is brought to you by the fine folk at Tenable Network Security. So if you need some vulnerability scanning or SIEM software, then you really need to go visit their website, tenable.com. These guys have been in that game for a long time. And on this week's show, we're revisiting the topic of Phantom O-Day with Ron Gula, the chief executive and co-founder of Tenable Network Security. And we'll also be chatting to him about whether or not the biggest threat to users in the future could actually be social engineering. But before we get into all of that, it's time for a check of the week's news headlines with Adam Boileau. And Adam, first cab off the rank this week. Some time ago, we covered the story of a researcher who did a talk. I think it was at DEF CON, wasn't it? He did a talk about how to hack a lot of these commonly used Magstripe door locks. And, you know, it was looking like there were millions of hotel rooms that were affected by this. And someone's now using it actually in the wild to break into people's hotel rooms and steal their things.
Yeah, I guess it's kind of hard to be surprised about that. There was reports of a guy breaking into Hyatt's in Houston and, you know, stealing laptops and things from people's rooms, yeah, using this particular door lock bypass technique. And of course, there's much hand wringing about whether the vendor is to blame and, you know, whether they should have done something about this by now, or whether or not it, you know, regular door locks are pickable with lock pick sets and, you know, it's a comparable thing. But yeah, either way, it's a pretty bad look for the vendor, Onity. Obviously not cool for the people who are staying in hotels that have vulnerable doors, which, you know, is probably a lot of us.
Yeah, well, it's kind of funny, this one, because we did actually cover, you know, the initial news. And then I remember someone was saying, well, there's 4 million rooms affected by this and there's no real easy workaround. So, you know, it's just one of those situations where the vendor's completely shitty security is like actually a massive problem now that it's deployed.
Yeah, I guess it's a good example of the crossover of, you know, responsible disclosure, full disclosure, into the real world. And increasingly with the way that, you know, we are using computer tech in the real world, you know, in things like, you know, SCADA systems and door systems and whatever, you know, the way we've traditionally done it in software, you know, like all the arguments that people on both sides of this argument have had, are really starting to become real for a much larger group of people.
Yeah, well, there's nothing much more real than coming back to your hotel room to find your laptop missing.
Well, exactly. Yeah. It's a bad thing.
It is a bad thing, DM. Now, speaking of bad things, we're used to covering all sorts of data breaches here. I don't know, you know, you see social security numbers getting stolen, unsalted, hashed MD5 passwords. But this breach that we're talking about may be a little bit more serious than that.
Yeah, so some a group calling themselves Parastu, which is apparently Farsi for swallow, and a fairly common name for women in Iran, owned a site that belongs to the International Atomic Energy Agency and published a statement about, you know, Israel's undeclared nuclear weapons program, and published a list of people who are advisors to the IAEA about nuclear issues, which is, you know, I guess, you know, given the fact that Iranian nuclear scientists keep getting mysteriously blown up by motorcycle bombers. Being on this particular list is probably not something you want out there in the public eye.
Hey, how you going, nuclear scientist? Shoot you in the face.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, it's not really what you look for. But yeah, as website defacements go, it's a pretty sensitive one, I think.
Yeah. No, I agree. The IAEA is probably not an organization where you would want their data leaking. So that's kind of a bummer. Now, yeah. An interesting bit of news here. There's a young Georgian bloke who he's 19 years old, and he had been claiming to have like a full end-to-end bug in Chrome. He was due to be presenting this bug at a conference, and then he said, oh no, I can't, I've been called up for compulsory military service, sorry, okay, thanks, bye.
Yeah, which, you know, there's a number of possible kind of interpretations of the story, aren't there? I mean, one is that he got called up for military service, and, you know, that's you know, you take that on its face value, and somewhere he's, you know, crawling through the mud and yelling whatever's Georgian for hoorah.
Yeah.
Or maybe he got called up into the, you know, Georgian army's cyber department and is currently cybering some Russians with a zero day, which, you know, I guess if you, you know, if you had citizens who had that sort of thing, then, you know, that would probably be a good idea if you were Georgia.
Georgia's recent history with Russia. I mean, they were at war not so long ago, actually, like, you know, shooting and bombing each other.
Well, yeah, exactly. And the Georgian, you know, cyber apparatus seems to be, you know, sort of small and well-formed, as they say. Mm. So, you know, I guess it's believable that, you know, they might have got their shit together and called the guy up. But, you know, a balance of probability, you know, you look at the bugs that this guy has previously reported in Chrome, and, you know, maybe he just didn't want to go to the con and get called on it.
Yeah. So it could be another Phantom O'Day scenario.
Yeah, well, I had a quick look at the bugs that he has reported in the past, and it's, you know, like 3 won't fixes and 2 invalids, which is not a great, you know, not a great record. And, you know, there's plenty of people out there who don't necessarily understand the difference between bugs and security bugs. And, you know, it seems certainly the assertion from Google's Justin Xu was that he's in that category.
Yes, right. Well, don't lose too much sleep, I guess, is what we're saying.
Well, I'm sure there's plenty of other Google Chrome Zero Day you can worry about, but just not this particular one.
Not so much. Now, look, speaking of O-Days in Chrome, Google's actually repaired a few of them.
Yeah, there's a bunch of bugs fixed. They've been paying out some of their, you know, modestly sized bug bounties, which, you know, it's good to see people cashing in on that. There was bugs on OS X's like GPU accelerated rendering. Like, well, you know, really does my browser need GPU accelerated rendering? I have to ask as a sidebar note. But yeah, they fixed a bunch of bugs, so you'll want to auto update your Chrome.
Well, it was interesting. I had a good chat to Ben Hawkes, who does work for Google at RuxCon, I think last year, just about all of this sort of fancy rendering that browsers are doing, like direct hardware. What?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I talked to Ben about some of the research and the assessment he did on their implementation of that. And there are some quite novel attack classes in there, like beyond, you know, sort of straight up memory corruption and implementation flaws. I mean, there are some really interesting things that you could do with that.
Because really, I want the weak link in my security chain being my graphics card driver, because they're so well written.
Well, yeah, you know, and I guess once we've run out of, you know, kernel font rendering bugs, then we can move on into that.
Yeah, it was interesting talking to Hawks about that because, you know, it sounds like one of those things that could be a complete disaster zone, but it looks like it is a manageable risk, and there's a lot of diversity out there in hardware. So it's, you know, it's not the great big fireball hurtling towards Earth that many people think it is, but you still got to ask yourself, indeed, why, oh why?
Well, exactly, yeah. I was pleasantly surprised, actually, when Hawks kind of described his research and the fact that it wasn't world-ending, because, yeah, I was expecting it to be terrible as well.
Yeah, yeah. Here's some code. Just run it. Okay. Yeah. Now, look, this next piece comes from a Chinese-based news website. It's been doing the rounds. It's a very, very interesting piece. I've just read it through Google Translate. ZDNet wrote a bit of an analysis on it. But I guess what makes it interesting is they're looking at... It's like reading a story on CNET about Huawei and the Chinese APT threat, except this one is about Cisco and those darned Americans and all their APTs.
Yeah, and it's actually quite an interesting piece, and I have to confess, I've also only read it through through Google Translate, so we may have lost some details.
You mean you don't speak fluent Mandarin? Oh my God, I'm getting a new news guy. This is outrageous.
It is, I agree. It's substandard. you should just, yeah, get a new one. No, it's a really interesting piece, and the you know, it feels in some respects like someone has gone to a lot of trouble to go through and find everything that Huawei has ever been accused of, and then cut and replace Cisco and print it out. But it does make quite a number of really cogent arguments. You know, for example, you know, saying, well, I mean, look at the hegemony of US software development and the fact that we are, you know, enslaved to, you know, an untrusted supply chain, and look what they did to Iran, and, you know, look how much of our networks run on Cisco gear. Yeah, and they're quite reasonable arguments. I mean, you know, you really could swap the words out, you know, China and Cisco and Huawei and... Sorry, China and the US and Huawei and Cisco. And it would read exactly, as you say, exactly like a CNET article. It's quite, you know, quite recent in places. And it is a very good read, I think, for anyone who's, you know, who's been following the, you know, the APT debate and the, you know, the sort of the upcoming cyber war between the superpowers.
Well, they say, you know, in this piece that China is almost naked standing next to the United States, which is armed to the teeth with what they call the Eight Diamond Front, which is Cisco, IBM, Google, Qualcomm, Intel, Apple, Oracle, and Microsoft. So maybe, you know, from a Western perspective, when we look at Huawei as being this huge issue, I mean, when you think about it from, when you're trying to threat model from the Chinese point of view, I mean, who would you rather be?
Well, exactly, yeah. Like, they do make some very good points. And, you know, and I mean, the Eight Diamond, that's, you know, it's quite a scary lineup. I mean, I was reading a piece
it's end-to-end ownage. I mean, when you're looking at Qualcomm, which is like baseband chipsets, you've got Intel, which is processors, you've got your operating system vendors, your business computing providers, and your routing infrastructure providers, and your database makers.
Well, exactly, yeah. And they had some numbers on like what percentage of China's internet traffic traverses Cisco kit and what percentage of their financial systems rely on Cisco kit. And obviously, you know, the dominance of Windows in the operating system market is a concern for them. So, you know, all the supply chain issues, absolutely, you can see their concerns, you know. I was watching, there was a video that was on the Wired's Danger Room blog. They were talking about Chinese drones that they were, you know, showing off in the air show. And this footage went inside the control room for the Chinese clone of the MQ-9 Reaper. And sure enough, in the control room, there's a bunch of boxes running stock Windows XP. Like, you can recognize the, you know, the nice green hills on the background. Anyway, and like, that's the crux of their problem right there. They've got these brand new, you know, stolen from America drones, and they have to run the software on Windows. So yeah, you can really see their argument, you know?
Yeah. Now an attack on a Romanian top-level domain register led to some pretty serious problems for Google and Yahoo.
Yeah, somebody hacked a DNS registrar in Romania and appears to be DNS hijacking a bunch of stuff out of Romania, including Yahoo and Google, Microsoft, PayPal, a bunch of other stuff. And when people went to those sites, they were redirected to a fairly bog standard defacement page, which, you know, kind of seems like a bit of a waste of a perfectly good DNS cache poisoning attack.
Exactly.
But yeah, obviously, you know, if you're in Romania, that would be pretty big news.
Haven't you heard of SSL strip? Guys, come on.
Yeah, well, exactly right. You could do a lot with that. But, you know, it's the similar sort of attack that we've seen against a number of registrars. We saw it here in New Zealand a few years back where they, you know, attacked Coca-Cola and put a picture of Bill Gates with a pie on his face. Like, what the f*** can do?
Yeah. Well, look, I think there was some sort of problem for Pakistani users as well out of this. But, yeah, it wasn't anything particularly, amazing. Now, here in Australia, the Defence Signals Directorate, which has a habit, I mean, they release their information security manual. There's an unclassified portion, which is just, you know, it's very much like one of those 7799 standards type documents, but actually pretty good. And they've got, you know, their top 50 things you should do in order of priority for your network. They've issued amazing guidance on cloud computing. It's really amazing because they're a government bureaucracy that has a habit of pumping out some very interesting material. And they've just issued some advice on BYOD that looks like it could be good advice.
Yeah, it's a very sane, very well thought out bit of advice. And, you know, if you're in an organization, I guess I'm looking primarily at you financial jerks, that's considering bring your own device, like, print this out, go and show it to someone who, you know, is responsible for signing off risk, because, you know, it does very neatly, very concisely, like within a couple of pages, describe exactly what the problems are and why it's a really bad idea, and hopefully should, you know, maybe start to talk people out of it. But yeah, you know, not nice to see, you know, consistently good advice coming out of the DSD.
Oh, look, we've been following the whole blockade of WikiLeaks by Visa, MasterCard and PayPal. Now, I think in one jurisdiction, it was found that, you know, Visa and MasterCard had acted illegally by, you know, in breach of contract by just withdrawing payment processing services for WikiLeaks. But according to the EU, in the EU jurisdiction, it's kosher, apparently.
Yeah, and I guess I'm a little bit surprised by that. I mean, you know, you'd kind of think that, you know, given their dominance in the market, that there would be some kind of, you know, reason that they could, you know, they could figure out something that they've done wrong, you know. I mean, given that, you know, the EU can blame Microsoft for, you know, not sharing their browsers around or whatever, that, you know, this would also be something they could, you know, complain about. But no, apparently it's not actually a problem.
Yeah, look, I mean, you know, people who listen to this show know that I'm not exactly a huge fan of Julian Assange and the way that he handled a lot of the leaks, particularly the information that Bradley Manning provided to, well, is alleged to have provided to WikiLeaks. But I still find the idea that a couple of, you know, card issuing brands can shut down what is essentially a political organization, I mean, that's just appalling.
Yeah, it does seem a bit shit that isn't a problem.
I mean, look, fair enough if there had been some sort of injunction, you know, pending a trial or charges or something, but they folded like a deck chair.
That's the metaphor you want, yes.
Right. Now, here in Australia, there's been a bit of news about some Romanians who've been done for a $30 million credit card fraud. I think it was something like 30,000 cards. Looks like, I mean, when you read between the lines, it looks like one of those situations where someone's gone after, you know, not very well secured POS systems through like RDP, weak RDP passwords or something like that. But cops have arrested 16 people.
Yeah, you're right. It does look like the... you know, the classic, point of sale intrusion sort of thing. But I think the thing that's really cool about this is the fact that, you know, clearly the AFP has enough traction with the Romanian National Police that they did what? They raided 36 properties with 200 police.
Yeah, in Romania,
In Romania. And that's pretty amazing. Like, the AFP must be really pleased to actually see that come together. And I imagine the AFP guys have been, sunk a lot of work into making that happen. So this is, it's quite... You know, it must be quite heartening for them.
Well, it's interesting, actually, because Romania used to be the absolute capital for eBay fraud. There were some very well-organized groups over there committing all sorts of, just all of your standard types of eBay fraud. And it was eBay that actually went in there and provided the police with a lot of resources and really helped them ramp up their anti-fraud capability. I sat through a presentation from one of eBay's anti-fraud guys in Sydney. It was a few years ago now, but it was... You know, often you get to these lunches, and it's the PR companies invite you and they sit down and they sort of PowerPoint you and it's all very boring. But it was really quite fascinating at looking at how, a company like eBay was able to go in there and really assist the police to just make that sort of offense not worth the trouble because you were going to get a knock on the door.
Yeah, well, I mean, clearly they've done some things right and it has, made a material difference.
Mm. Now, last week we covered the news that Andrew Ornheimer, a.k.a. Weave, had been found guilty over his role in slurping data on 100,000 AT&T users through a terrible web portal that they set up. It was a direct object ref bug. Second person's been found guilty in that, they're calling it a hack. It wasn't really. Second person's been found guilty, so we'll await sentencing.
Yeah. And of course, they're making some statements about, how this is going to have a chilling effect on security research, just disclosing blah, blah, blah. But, that's just kind of, doesn't read very true to anyone who knows the people involved.
Yeah. So, I mean, still probably, this is probably a shakeup for him. But, it would be a shame to see guys going to prison for, exploiting a direct object ref bug and then not actually doing anything with the data.
Well, yeah. But, I mean, those guys are kind of dicks.
I know they're dicks, but,
Yeah. Yeah, well, yeah, you're right, I guess. But they are kind of dicks.
They are kind of dicks, I'll give you that. Now, there's some hard-coded backdoors in Samsung printers. Yay. Great place to put your bloody, testing kit.
Well, yeah, exactly. Now, this is apparently a researcher found a hard-coded SNMP community string a bunch, nearly all of Samsung's printer firmwares up until a couple of months ago. So if you've got a Samsung printer, in theory, they're going to patch it for relatively recent printers sometime before the end of the month, I believe, which I guess is tomorrow.
But that's probably something like our listeners, are used to following, advisories for, all of their standard enterprise computing kit and their operating system and their SOE and whatever. But this is one that, you're going to have to dick around a bit to fix this.
Yeah, well, I mean, the irony is, of course, you can use SNMP to reflash the printer, which is the funny thing, right? Because, you can, write Trojan firmware and then use this bug to flash it with Trojan firmware and off you go and proceed onwards to, own the printer or pivot through the printer onto the rest of the network, all that sort of thing. That's clearly a bad day
there. Network printers traditionally have been a pretty good place to hide on a network, haven't they?
Yeah, well, there's a long and proud tradition of stealing documents out of them, of pivoting through them, of using them as, places to stash your wares or whatever on the, built-in FTP server. Printers have long been a high-risk thing. I think the thing that I guess made me particularly amused about this bug is that even if you turn SNMP off on the printer, it's still vulnerable. To the magic hard-coded SNMP string. So, yeah, that's pretty nice.
How does that work?
Yeah.
No, I'm serious.
Well, I mean, I don't know. US CERT says that even turning SNMP off does not actually disable SNMP properly.
So, turning SNMP off doesn't turn SNMP off.
Yes.
Okay.
That seems to be the crux of the assertion. Yes.
Yeah. Just wanted to make sure I got that right. Now, Krebs on Security is reporting that there's a Java Zero Day on sale for five digits, which is, a fair bit of cash.
Yeah, like clearly someone who's not familiar with the process of supply and demand. when there's lots of supply, demand is lower, so it costs less. 50,000 dollars for a Java bug. Yeah, I'm pretty sure you can find them cheaper than that.
But, you know, it's just the story, isn't it? Which is, really, it has been the year when we've watched the attacks move away from, you know, contemporary current versions of Adobe products, and definitely Java is the last realm. Not that it affects users of Macs, because... you know, OS X has basically nuked Java. So, really, I mean, you're thinking... Java's looking a bit wobbly, isn't it? As a mainstream bit of software, I mean, the idea that your mum needs a bloody Java runtime on her system.
Certainly, I think the concept of Java runtimes as a browser plugin is something that needs to just hurry the f*** up and die, because it is. It's an awful idea. Like, no one needs a Java applet in their browser. You know, it's the year 2012 AD. Get rid of it. But, you know, unfortunately, Java has a very, very long future ahead of it on back-end systems and corporate systems. But, you know, that's, I guess, less of an issue than having it in your browser.
Yeah, yeah. So we'll actually see if that one materializes. A lot of this Phantom O'Day floating about. Now, speaking of an O'Day that actually got patched, we saw Cartel's fantastic talk at KiwiCon, all about owning managed service providers. We spoke about that last week. Kaseya has actually patched the vulnerability that he demonstrated at the conference.
Yeah, and they've rolled out updates which are deployed through their automatic patching mechanism. So in theory, if you have one of these systems and you've got auto update turned on, then you should be patched already.
Mm-hmm, that's right. But you've got to, I mean, look, the nature of the bugs that he was showing off were just so boneheaded that you've got to wonder how many other, you know, you just pick it up and shake it, and I'm sure a few more bugs are going to fall out.
Well, you know, of course, right? And sadly, pretty much all enterprise management software is like that.
Yay. Hello to the Tivoli team at IBM and
anything from anything made by CA.
Yep. What was their one called again?
The Tivoli one.
No, CA. What was this?
Shit, I don't remember.
And HP got one as well. Which
yeah,
is
and there's
horrible.
BMC Patrol, and there's
unclean, unclean, dirty. Right. Okay, well, moving on, and a piece of software that I've never heard of, but is apparently quite a popular website analytics open source tool. It's called Piwik, P-I-W-I-K. It got backdoored.
Yeah, somebody owned their site via WordPress plugin, apparently, and then backdoored it to send you off to you know, some dodgy site that was used to normally, I believe, fish people, but... yeah, if you were downloading that particular piece of open source software and you got it during the affected time, yeah, you probably want to go and look at the advice that the Piwik guys have given about so how to clean up this particular thing.
Everybody's getting owned.
Yep.
That's my little own happy dance. Okay, well, look, moving on to a more traditional type of bug, and it's funny, you'll hear me talk about this with Ron Guler in this week's sponsor interview. A guy has found like an absolute stack of SCADA bugs while making a turkey for Thanksgiving.
Yeah, well, yeah, you know, he found a whole bunch, you know, bunch of SCADA bugs. I mean, let's face it, realistically, the hard thing about SCADA bugs is getting the SCADA equipment to test, right, or getting hold of the management software or whatever particular thing that you're looking for bugs like. That's the difficult bit. The moment anyone gets hold of any SCADA software, yeah, you know, bugs are just going to fall out, right? I mean, you know, I imagine you can, you know, you can point burp at it in full auto, you know, go away and have your turkey dinner, come back and there'll be 25 bugs for you, which apparently is what this guy did.
Yeah. So for all you critical infrastructure types out there, just, you know, God, it's enough to make you want to change careers, I'd imagine.
Yeah, yeah, just go to the pub. Drink
that's
beer.
It. Go to the pub. Just become an alcoholic. It'll, you know, yeah, probably lead to further long-term happiness than actually trying to secure that crap.
Sadly, yes.
Now, Symantec has issued a report, which has since been played down by the Iranian government. There's a worm, like a rigidige, proper old-school worm/virus that's going after Microsoft SQL databases, which is kind of interesting. And it's targeting tables that have, like, Persian words and stuff like that. So maybe aimed at Iran.
Yeah, just a little bit. I thought it's quite a cool little piece of malware, really. I mean, propagates apparently through that, you know, standard sort of malware mechanisms. But yeah, looks for SQL databases, checks for specific database names, and then looks for specific tables in that database, and then drops ones with names like sellers and person and buyer name, and then the Persian word for savings and the Persian word for instant loans. Mm. So clearly somebody has a, you know, owes somebody some money and is attempting very creatively, I might add, to get rid of it.
That's right. And that's actually it for this week's news, Adam. So we've got one more next week, and then it's the year in review special the week after that. So we're wrapping it all up, buddy.
Yeah, we're getting near the end. Although it's been a fun year and lots of good news to cover.
Excellent. Yeah, and we hope what normally happens doesn't happen. Like normally, I go on holiday. And then, like, Google gets owned or Stuxnet happens or, you know, that's usually what happens when I go on leave.
Yeah, maybe it'll be, like, full-on cyber war while you're out surfing.
Cyber war. That would be Drink. Fun. Open cyber war. All right, that's it, buddy. We'll chat to you next week. Thanks again.
Cheers, Pat. Talk to you then.
Insomnia Security's Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's news headlines. Next up, it's time for our feature interview with Rex Warren of Leviathan Security over there in the United States. Now, the Leviathan guys have been working on some interesting stuff for DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. Now, you remember Dr. Watson, the crash dump handler for Windows, the one that is now baked into the operating system? Well, Microsoft has been using this functionality for years to figure out what's going on in its ecosystem. It's extremely valuable telemetry that can alert Redmond to all sorts of bugs, both in its own software and third-party stuff, and not just security bugs, just like crashes and stuff. Well, Dr. Watson is actually fairly configurable, and the guys at Leviathan have been doing their best to see if they can use these crash dumps to figure out when someone's exploit code has caused a crash. Rex Warren joined me by phone to discuss what they're calling the Maya Project.
What we're doing is basically recreating what Microsoft has been doing for years. Somewhere around like 80% of Microsoft bug fixes and product fixes are found through this mechanism. And so we're not really doing anything different in that aspect, except for we're specifically looking to see whether or not we can find security-related bugs in this mechanism.
And so basically, how does it work? I mean, you're just capturing the crash dumps at the gateway and then analyzing them? Is it as simple as that?
It is as simple as that. Dr. Watson, or the mechanism behind Dr. Watson, which is actually fairly old now, is very configurable. You can set it to transfer the crash dump over the network to any host you'd like. And then you can also, configure it to run over TLS or, you know, HTTPS, basically. And so you can get a fairly secure communications going with a server to collect crash dumps. Now, we've also extended this year in the second phase of this project to include Linux distros. So we're working on getting a crash dump, which they don't have quite the facility, but they have the kernel-level hooks to be able to allow it. We just have to come up with a program that basically emulates what Dr. Watson does and dump the crash dumps to the server.
So you're using this to try to spot failed exploitation, right?
Correct. And basically what we've been seeing is, in our thought process around this, is that failed attempts generally result in crashes. So somebody is, you know, clicking on a browser link or whatever, the thing just crashes and crashes and crashes. Finally, they'll get their program run because they want to see the little hamster dance or whatever. Then they'll be exploited, and whatever will run on the computer will run. Now, what we're trying to do is trying to aggregate those first few crash dumps because, you know, it's fairly hard to get an exploit to run repeatedly nowadays. ASLR and DAP kind of ruined it for the easy days of getting something to crash reliably. So we're looking at the odds of basically allowing that to happen.
How can you tell when something's an exploitation attempt versus just a regular crash? Because I would imagine that would be kind of difficult, right?
That is basically the hard problem. And that's so the trivial stuff is collecting the crash dumps, and the hard stuff is actually doing the analyzing. So what we're trying to do is recreate what an analyst would do, you know, in a forensics-type situation, right? So we've got two methods of attack. One is pretty straightforward. Look at the stack, do a stack recreation to find out what would have caused the current stack to be in the state it is, and then try and backtrace it to see what may have caused it. And Tim, unfortunately, is not on the phone with us. He's pretty good at telling us exactly what kind of failures occur to be able to trigger that kind of thing. Now, the other thing we've got going is, which is pretty much our unique idea, and that's the emulation side. So what we do is we divide up the crash dump, basically the memory portion of it, and say, okay, you know, this is what was left over, and whatever exploit was trying to do was going to try and run something in that memory. So what we do is we just go through memory and try and run it. We throw it through an emulator and see what it does.
And then you can be like, aha, shellcode.
Exactly. So if the shellcode is somehow obfuscated, we're running it, so we're basically running the unobfuscating algorithm that basically provides the shellcode that's going to try to attempt to run.
So have you guys, I mean, I imagine you guys would have been testing this on some networks by now. How effective has it been? I mean, have you been pleasantly surprised, or has it been like, meh, kind of what you expected?
Well, we've moved on to phase two, which means we're on a little bit bigger budget now, and we're expanding the scope. We have not actually run it on a live environment, right? Basically, what we've done is created programs that will cause crash dumps. Basically, Metasploit, run the programs through Metasploit, have the Metasploit crash a program, have that crash dump sent over, analyze it, and see whether or not we detect it or not. The first phase was actually a lot more successful than we thought. We had created tiny programs to execute because they take, you know, a crash dump can be very large for a large program. You're going to get all that dang memory that is consumed. What we had done is created some small test programs to try and avoid that. Now, MIT came in. They're the testing facility for DARPA and basically said, well, you know, we don't know what you, you know, we understand what you're trying to do, but we understand what we needed to do. So here's some crash dumps basically for, or here, we're going to try and run some exploits against real programs like IE and Java and things like that. And we were able to detect the exploits going on in IE and not in Java, but that was because Java was capturing its own crash dump and doing something interesting with it.
Which is typical Oracle, but anyway.
Exactly. So part of phase two was to be able to go through and find the hooks that Java was getting into so that we can avoid that and have it go through the regular crash dump facility.
So generally speaking, like how often are you able to successfully and automatically identify failed exploitation versus you know, not detecting it?
In our tests on, especially for things like heap spray or something like that, where just the program tries to just basically try and put its exploit in or the shell code wherever in memory that it can, we're pretty good at detecting that. Because it's, you know, it's all over the place. The other things that we had difficulty, but again, where phase two was to expand on, was ROP type programming. So our chief scientist Patrick Stack has been working on that problem for the last basically 4 months, trying to get the emulator to be able to detect what is going on in the cases of ROP.
Because ROP would be quite difficult to pick up, wouldn't it? Because it's, you know, it's sort of all over the shop and weird and chained and bits of it everywhere.
Right. And that's, I guess, basically detection mechanism is that normal programs aren't going to really be quite that chopped up and running little return programs here and return programs there and whatever.
So it's kind of funny. You can almost pick it because it's obfuscated.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. So really, what's the application for this? I mean, are you guys being funded to create a boxed product, or is this going to be something that's just used in government? And what will that use be?
I don't know what the motivations of DARPA are. I can only give you our motivations. And what we would actually like to see a box product. And we had kind of thrown out some ideas on, you know, maybe throw it up in the cloud and have people send crash dumps like Microsoft does. I think we're a little way ahead of that. The crash dumps that Microsoft does generally are tiny. They do a mini dump. We tend to program it to do a full dump, and which means a lot of memory and a lot of data being sent over the network, which would be probably prohibitive, but we see being able to install into a large enterprise, being able to use the basically an aggregate of a lot of computers to be able to tell whether or not things are going on in their network. And the whole idea behind the thing is to lessen the time of from detection of the attack to being able to do something about the attack, right? So right now, we've had customers that have gone 2 years without understanding that they have an attack, or that they've been successfully attacked and have been penetrated. Mm. We're trying to get that detection rate down to, you know, at least hours or days, right?
It's interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, one of the approaches that I'm seeing becoming a little bit popular, you got, you know, companies like NetWitness and, you know, these guys that do almost like your big data analysis. They're actually doing your packet captures and, you know, replaying stuff against new signatures and things like that. There's a bunch of guys here called Packet Loop who do that. Have you guys looked at the idea of saving network data, you know, so you can get your crash dump and then you can actually replay what happened over the network? Or I suppose you don't, I mean, you're capturing the memory, you're capturing the shellcode, you're capturing what's left over, but have you thought about combining that with PCAPs, basically, so that you can capture the exploit?
Yeah, we have. Actually, Dave Dietrich is just down the road, down at University of Washington, and we've been working with him the past 6 months, basically, helping him fund his, basically the same thing. He's got a large network detection program, and he feeds it all into one thing and then does, you know, data analysis on it. And we have had the idea of basically combining the two where, like, okay, we have had this attack. It came from this certain area. Now go back and look at the network logs and see what else may have happened in your enterprise or in your whatever's in your zone of being able to look at, right?
But is he looking at logs or is he looking at actual network data like PCAPs, like raw packets?
I think he's got both. So I'm not sure how much PCAP data he's got going and how much sensor data he's got going, which and what the difference between the two would be.
It's kind of hard, too, with the timing with packet captures, because you might have someone's email get pulled down to their system and they don't open that attachment until later. So the timing of the actual PCAP is not going to match the timing of the crash dump. It will with a browser exploit, but maybe not something in a mail attachment or, you know, like a PDF or something like that.
Sure. There's going to be all kinds of issues like that. I mean, just the issue of storing a lot of PCAP data is going to be a problem.
So is there anyone else really doing this in a boxed product form at the moment?
We don't know of anybody yet, but, you know, we've been kind of heads down focused on getting the product out for DARPA and haven't really, you know, looked at the market to see what else is going on out there.
And do you know when we might expect to actually see this available?
Maybe a year. You know, we've been slowly approaching some of our customers and wondering whether they want to be able to help test it for us. And there's obviously, you know, when you're looking at data like this, there's sensitivities around privacy and things like that. So we're trying to be sensitive to our clients on what they want to be able to look at and what they don't. So.
Yes. Can we please pull gigabytes of memory out of your network?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, that is an interesting thing. I mean, you could set up something locally within there, couldn't you, that you could access and just view the analysis rather than the...
I think that's the most successful way of doing it is to basically have it under, you know, their IT's control.
So in terms of an effective measure to figure out when you're being OD'd, how effective is it in picking up OD'd attempts?
Well, it's not signature-based, so... we're not worried about something new happening. All we're looking for is whether or not the stack-based thing can filter it out or whether or not the emulator can run it. So I think it's very effective personally right now. I think there are certainly going to be ways of getting around it someday, and we'll have to look at those. You know, it's always that arms race against the detection and then...
Well, I was going to ask, I mean, the way around this, the obvious way around this would be to write perfect exploits. And the Chinese aren't very good at doing that at the moment, are they?
No. Probably the way around this is to have the user run it in an actual program. And people are always doing that kind of thing. And unless you lock down systems, you know, they're going to be able to get around it.
So this sort of narrows your vectors down to having like a good signed application that someone's just going to run.
Exactly.
So exploitation-free pwnage, basically, is your biggest threat.
Right.
Well, Rex Warren, thank you very much for joining us on Risky Business to have a bit of a chat about your wonderful Dr. Watson zero-day detection stuff.
All right. Well, thank you for having me, Patrick.
Rex Warren of Leviathan Security there, and isn't it great that over the last few years, detection has actually advanced? There was this innovation flat spot for years and years, and just over the last few years, we've seen seam gear emerging that actually works, deep packet inspection stuff from companies like RSA NetWitness that actually works, ideas like El Jefe from Immunity, big data cloud analytics like Packet Loop, and now stuff like this. So it's really quite satisfying to see some new and novel approaches to detection. Anyway, speaking of seam gear that actually works, it's time for this week's sponsor interview with Ron Gula of Tenable Network Security. Cheesy segue, I know. Now, Ron, for those of you who don't know who he is the chief executive and co-founder of Tenable, but he was also behind Network Security Wizards back in the day and even wrote the Dragon IDS. He did some time at the NSA yonks ago and has basically developed a reputation as someone who really knows what he's talking about. Now, regular listeners would know about the challenge that Adobe has been facing lately with a Russian company claiming to have O'Day in Reader 11, but not providing a sample. So are they full of it, or do they actually have the bug? And as you heard in the news earlier, that young Georgian guy who was supposed to present his Chrome Zero Day pulled out of his talk citing military service obligations. Now, is that just a convenient excuse, or did he actually have the goods? The point is, it's hard to know these days, and rumours of O'Day attract the same type of headlines as actual O'Day. So I got Ron Gula on the line to chat about it, and here's what he had to say.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting phenomenon because there's a lot of research going on. There's a lot of opportunities to disclose. But frankly, what gets into the press and what gets into the exploit kits and what actually ends up gets in patches tends to be three different things these days. Like the recent Java Zero Day that we had, boy, there was a bunch of blogs, a bunch of videos, a bunch of YouTube things. It wasn't hard to understand. But when these new types of exploits are out there that have to do with bypassing sandboxes and things like that, they're probably very, very truthful that they can do these things, but they're harder to do in practice and exploit at scale. So I definitely think, you know, the proof's in the pudding, the burden of proof's on them. But, you know, sometimes demonstrating these things is just as hard as coming up with the exploit itself.
But I mean, people are really, it's almost possible these days that it's really easy to prank the entire security community by claiming that you have something coveted. So, I mean, I wonder if the media has to stop reporting these unconfirmed O'Days just to stop encouraging people.
The media is always going to want to talk about the next zero day, the next worm, the next virus. And I don't really have an issue with that. The concern that I have, though, is it puts the focus in the wrong spot. I mean, right now, every computer that's out there has zero days in it that might get disclosed by a hacker or a researcher, however you want to call it, might be to get disclosed by the vendor themselves. But people don't really look at their computer or their applications from the lens of all the new vulnerabilities that are going to be there a year from now or 2 years from now. So it really puts the focus on doing something and reacting versus planning. Mm. And that's really, I'm much more interested about, you know, reducing complexity, reducing the, you know, proliferation of not viruses, but web browsers, applications, things like that. Reduce the exploit paths, the attack paths.
Now, before we started this interview, Ron, you asked me to ask you about the SCADA turkey guy?
Absolutely. So over Thanksgiving, Aaron Portnoy found 20 or 23 different vulnerabilities in SCADA systems while he was cooking his Thanksgiving turkey dinner here in the U.S., right? And I always think that this is kind of a really interesting, sort of a different way to look at this whole disclosure process, because on one hand, you got him just not really trying that hard and finding 23 vulnerabilities and disclosing doing the right thing. And then you got the two gentlemen you spoke about, the one from Georgia and the group from Russia. Now, in both cases, they're both disclosing vulnerabilities, and we can all talk about that. But I like to think about, okay, well, should Aaron have worked another hour? You know, does he have a responsibility? Does he have, you know, a responsibility to everybody to find all these other vulnerabilities? Whereas these other people, you know, maybe they found them, maybe they didn't. The point it still brings me back to is that you have vulnerabilities in your network that haven't been disclosed, and you still need to practice against them because they're going to get disclosed sooner or later.
Now, look, there's something I wanted to ask you about, and I find this kind of interesting, is this whole concept of exploit-free ownage. We've got where you've got the users installing stuff themselves. It really seems like with some of the more modern operating system mitigations, with some new technologies that are coming online, like, in this week's feature interview, we chatted to some of the guys from Leviathan Security about what they were doing with capturing crash reports and trying to work out if there'd been failed exploitation attempts. When we look at the sort of threat landscape, do you reckon in the future the primary vector could really be social engineering? And if so, do you think we might be able to start improving users' responses, you know, in that threat environment?
I think it's a really interesting question. Training users, there's been a lot of debate over, you know, the human vector and whatnot. There's been a lot of really good press recently, specifically, you know, SourceFire had one of their VRT folks sort of get the fake antivirus, anti-malware folks on the phone installing, you know, basically a backdoor onto their system, thinking it was indeed vulnerable. When you look at the social exploitation or social engineering side of it, there's a wide variety of targets, right? You have age, right? You're older, people who aren't as familiar with computers, didn't grow up with them, might be more trusting of somebody claiming to be Microsoft. An organization who's relying on their help desk might be more susceptible to somebody spoofing, you know, a fake help desk call, different things like that. So again, that's part of your, you know, risk profile doing that. Now, will everything go 100% back to social? I really doubt that. I mean, we're seeing more and more automated exploits. There's more and more things that are targeted in an automated fashion that don't require a human to be involved. And then some of this is, you know, things like botnets where it does require you to kind of visit a website with a browser, you know, go to Facebook, things like that. I don't really consider that social. That's still a technical.
I agree. But I mean, I'm genuinely talking about just tricking a user into installing something that, you know, may or may not be signed or whatever, but, you know, just actually tricking. So you're not actually taking, you're not actually using any sort of memory corruption whatsoever. Do you think we could be heading towards a world where the majority of ownage occurs, not through exploitation, but just through stupid user installations?
I really doubt that, because the access path there is so tactical, right? If I was going to target you, I have to get you to install a piece of software, and I have to convince you of doing that. I might be very clever, and you might fall for my cleverness, but that doing that at scale is really, really difficult. The other thing is everybody's trending to using the same apps, right? I mean, nobody uses MySpace anymore. They all use Facebook, you know, and so trying to come up with a new fake, you know, social networking site, that might catch on to a few people, but it's not going to be a mass, you know, sort of virus or botnet like we have today.
And obviously there's been a big swing towards using app stores and things like that. The way people consume software seems to have changed a great deal. At least there's been some sort of, you know, checking done on that software before it's installed, in the case of iOS and even Google's Play Store, right?
There is. And, you know, with the exception of platforms like Xbox, you know, where you pretty much have to buy, you know, Xbox or, you know, PlayStation, you know, type games, as much as there'll be an app store for Microsoft or there's an app store for Apple, for the operating systems, for the desktops, for iOS, for example, there's always going to be third-party markets for major types of software that the operating system vendors just simply don't, you know, want to support or offer. You know, for example, on iOS, there's a lot of, you know, products perhaps from Microsoft or other third parties that Apple just has no real interest in putting on their app store, maintaining, charging for, things like that. So there's always going to be this market for these third-party things. And even systems like the iPad and the iPhone, where they're closed, I think as time goes on, there's going to be more and more pressure to put more and more apps that are on there. And again, if there's malicious software there in those walled gardens, so to speak, it's going to be removed, it's going to be found, it's not going to be a major issue. It's the third-party stuff that doesn't come through that app store that's going to be a big deal.
Some good news for a change. Well, Ron, thank you very much for joining us, mate, and we'll chat to you again in 2013.
Happy New Year, happy Thanksgiving, always a pleasure.
Ron Gula of Tenable Network Security there with this week's sponsor interview. And big thanks to Tenable for its continued support of the Risky Business podcast. Thank you very much. Now, I'm playing two feature tracks this week, one after the other. I actually recorded these myself with my field recorder. Lloyd Spiegel, I've played on the show before. He's an exceptionally talented guitar player based in Melbourne, but he tours pretty regularly and actually does pub gigs here in Byron Bay, basically because he likes to visit the town. Everywhere else, he does ticketed shows. So I took along my field recorder to one of his gigs so I could capture his live pub sound. And Lloyd is a friend, so he didn't mind that I did this. And he even has a special message for Risky Business listeners. So here's two songs from Lloyd, recorded at the Railway Friendly Bar in Byron Bay, Australia, last Tuesday night. Enjoy. And for God's sakes, go see one of his shows. He even toured with B.B. King when he was a teenager. This guy is good. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.
Hey, this is Lloyd Spiegel. I'm a musician for a living. I made a lot of hacks. But when I'm worried about computer hacking, I head to Risky Business to listen to my buddy Pat talking it up.
Beatles up here. Touring across America, I was 16 when I got there. I wasn't allowed to have like an international driver's license or anything like that. I used to do 300 gigs a year in 45 American states, just traveling on the Greyhound bus. There's not much to do on a 3-day bus ride but talk to the guy next to you. So one day I'm talking to the guy next to me about women. That's what we do when we get together, we talk about women. And he says, you know, next week I'll have been married for 37 years. And as he says that, a tear runs down his cheek. I said, that's beautiful, you're obviously still very much in love. He said, nah, I just realized that if I killed her, if I went and met her, I'd be out of jail by now. It sounded like a blues song. If I killed you when I met you, I'd be out of jail by now. If I killed you when I met you, I'd be out of jail by now. She don't want me, baby. She didn't love me now. walked out here. Here's when I met you. I've been out of jail by now. You know that you don't want me, baby. You know that you don't want me, baby.
I see.